This is David Hufford, Alchemy of Desire, November 17th, 2000.
On the one hand, I was aware when I wrote down the three ideas that the alchemy of desire was the one that I was most interested in. But another part of me put it at the bottom of the list, hoping that the committee that was reviewing these ideas would pick one of the others. Because I think in somewhere I knew that it would be a lot of work, and I didn't want to have to do it. These other two ideas I already had sort of written, you know. But as you can see, my unconscious got me to do it anyway. So now its time has come. So we'll just have to see what comes. The more I reflect on it, the more I have come to realize that desire is the central energizing force in Jung's life and work. Sometimes in the background, hardly noticed. Sometimes in the foreground, very obvious. But it is always there. Tonight, I want to share with you the shape of my ideas and thoughts and feelings to this point, and hopefully it will generate a conversation between us that will be fruitful and enlivening. As I thought about what I wanted to say this evening, I realized that there were several ways I could approach it. One thing I am not going to do tonight, however, is to try to define desire philosophically. That would be an entirely different lecture, and we would probably never get to the end of it. Instead, I want to take a typically Jungian approach to the topic of desire and circumambulate the concept as it emerges in Jung's life and work, walk around it, and look at it from several different angles. By doing this, I hope that a more or less complete picture will emerge of how Jung understood and experienced desire and how important it is in human life. I'm going to start by talking about the conflict between Jung and Freud and what one of the central conflicts was that destroyed their friendship. By Jung's own description, the conflict about the nature of desire was the central factor in the breakup between Jung and Freud. The loss of that relationship propelled Jung into his confrontation with the unconscious, as he calls it in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And he spent the rest of his life making sense of his experience during that time, for himself and for us. During the years of their friendship, Freud and Jung came to have very different ideas about what desire is and how it functions. For Freud, the basic human drive, which he called libido, was sexuality. Every human accomplishment derives from sexual desire or its sublimation, he felt. This includes religion, as Freud believed that all images of God were unconscious symbols created in response to the need to control and subdue libido. Jung, on the other hand, saw libido as general psychic energy that could derive from several sources: sexuality, hunger, and especially spirituality. Jung describes in Memories, Dreams, Reflections an interaction with Freud in which the conflict over this issue of libido became too obvious for him to ignore. He writes, "I can still recall vividly how Freud said to me, 'My dear Jung, promise me never to abandon the sexual theory. That is the most essential thing of all. You see, we must make a dogma of it, an unshakable bulwark.' He said that to me with great emotion, in a tone of a father saying, 'And promise me this one thing, dear son, that you will go to church every Sunday.' In some astonishment, I asked him, 'A bulwark against what?' To which he replied, 'Against the black tide of mud.' And here he hesitated for a moment and then added, 'Of occultism.' This was the thing that struck at the heart of our friendship. I knew that I would never be able to accept such an attitude. What Freud seemed to mean by occultism was virtually everything that philosophy and religion, including the rising contemporary science of parapsychology, had learned about the psyche. And Jung might have added that Freud was also referring to everything that Jung had learned and believed about the psyche. Jung's break with Freud helped to free Jung to acknowledge his understanding that psychic energy was primarily numinous and spiritual in origin, coming from the unconscious and the God image. And this is another quote from Jung about this issue. He says, "It is a widespread error to imagine that I do not see the value of sexuality. On the contrary, it plays a large part in my psychology as an essential, though not the sole, expression of psychic wholeness. But my main concern has been to investigate, over and above its personal significance and biological function, its spiritual aspect and its numinous meaning, and thus to explain what Freud was so fascinated by but unable to grasp." He goes on, "Sexuality is of the greatest importance as the expression of the thonic spirit. That spirit is the other face of God, the dark side of the God image." Does everyone know what thonic means? It's spelled C-H-T-H-O-N-I-C. And it means it's relating to the gods of the underworld. The root means of the earth. So it's earthy. So if we had to summarize the difference in the conflict between Freud and Jung, we might say that for Freud, sexual libido is the ultimate source of the God image. But for Jung, the self, in the form of the God image, is the source of all libido, sexual and otherwise. One result of this conflict was that Jung stopped using Freud's term, libido, preferring instead the term psychic energy. He saw this as a more general concept, similar to the concept of energy in physics. For Jung, psychic energy is desire and emotion, the lifeblood of the psyche. But why did he emphasize the spiritual nature of desire? When we read Memories, Dreams, Reflections, it becomes clear that as a result of numinous experiences and dreams, Jung had as a very personal interest in religion and spirituality from an early age. It was not a coincidence that his medical school thesis was about a young medium who also happened to be his cousin, although he didn't mention that when he wrote the thesis. But one experience in particular from his early adolescence stands out as a potential source of Jung's more mature perspective on the spiritual nature of unconscious experience and desire. And now I'm going to tell you a short story. It's the story of God and Basil Cathedral. For any of you who've read Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, this might be familiar to you. This is Jung writing in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. "One fine summer day, I came out of school at noon and went to the cathedral square. The sky was a glorious blue, the day one of radiant sunshine. The roof of the cathedral glittered, the sun sparkling from the new, brightly glazed tiles. I was overwhelmed by the beauty of the sight and thought, the world is beautiful, and the church is beautiful, and God made all this, and sits above it far away in the blue sky on a golden throne, and here came a great hole in my thoughts, a choking sensation. I felt numbed and knew only, don't go on thinking. Something terrible is coming, something I don't want to think, something I dare not even approach. But why? Because I would be committing the most frightful of sins, the sin against the Holy Ghost, which cannot be forgiven. Anyone who commits that sin is damned to hell for all eternity. Needless to say, Jung, the 15-year-old Jung, was extremely shaken. He spent 3 torturous days and nights trying to keep himself from thinking the terrible thought that he knew he couldn't think. By the 3rd night, he also knew that he could not resist much longer. He asked himself, "What does God want? To act or not to act? I must find out what God wants with me, and I must find out right away." Being the person he was at the time, he tried to think his way out of this problem. "God knows that I cannot resist much longer, and he does not help me, although I am on the point of having to commit an unforgivable sin. In his omnipotence, he could easily lift this compulsion from me, but evidently he is not going to. Can it be that he wishes to test my obedience by imposing on me the unusual task of doing something against my own moral judgment? Is it possible that God wishes to see whether I am capable of obeying his will, even though my faith and my reason raise before me the specters of death and hell?" I thought it over again and again and arrived at the same conclusion. "Obviously, God also desires me to show courage," I thought. "If that is so, and I go through with it, then he will give me his grace and illumination." You have to remember that even though he had a lot of arguments with his father, God was the son of a minister. God was the son of a minister too, right? No, that's right. God was the son of a carpenter. I forget. Right? Anyway, never mind. Jung, yes. Well, little. That's a Jungian slip, right? So, Jung says, "I gathered all my courage as though I were about to leap forthwith into hellfire and let the thought come. I saw before me the cathedral, the blue sky. God sits on his golden throne, high above the world, and from under the throne an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the walls of the cathedral asunder. So that was it. I felt an enormous and indescribable relief. Instead of the expected damnation, grace had come upon me, and with it an unutterable bliss such as I had never known. I wept for happiness and gratitude. The wisdom and goodness of God had been revealed to me now that I had yielded to his inexorable command. It was as though I had experienced an illumination. It was obedience which brought me grace, and after that experience, I knew what God's grace was. One must be utterly abandoned to God. Nothing matters but fulfilling his will. Otherwise, all is folly and meaninglessness. From that moment on, when I experienced grace, my true responsibility began. Why did God befoul his cathedral? That, for me, was a terrible thought. But then came the dim understanding that God could be something terrible. I had experienced a dark and terrible secret. It overshadowed my whole life, and my entire youth can be understood in terms of this secret. This was perhaps Jung's first conscious encounter with the power of the unconscious as a personality that desires to have a relationship with him and enter into his world. I wonder if this experience is the first time Jung realized something that he would say later, that every encounter with the self is a defeat for the ego. We can see the traces of this experience in Jung's more mature understanding of our relationship to the unconscious and the God image. For Jung, psychic energy is primarily spiritual in nature, coming from the unconscious, often in ways that bring us in conflict with our ego expectations. At the beginning of Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Jung sums up his life. My life is the story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in the unconscious seeks outward manifestation, and the personality too desires to evolve out of its unconscious conditions and to experience itself as a whole. In a way, everything I am saying tonight is contained in these two sentences. The unconscious, as personified by the self or the God image, as Jung said, desires to realize itself in human life. The task of human consciousness is to assist in this realization. It is the task that gives life its meaning, as well as its struggle and conflict. What does Jung mean by self-realization? This phrase is rather elusive, and we might have a tendency to skip right over it, assuming we know what it means. But when we look closely at Jung's work, the way he talks about the unconscious and what it desires, two things emerge. First, Jung said that the unconscious, as personified by the self or the God image, wants to be self-aware, conscious of itself and its creation. So becoming conscious is one meaning of self-realization. Second, the unconscious also desires to realize itself in human life, to become real. In biblical language, the self wants to incarnate in human life. It wants to be born into reality. However, the unconscious needs us to do that. It can only enter the world with our help, through our action. Our task as human beings is to become conscious of the contents that press upward from the unconscious, to reflect on these experiences and translate them into human forms, Jung said. As far as we can tell, the sole purpose of our existence is to bring the light of consciousness to the darkness of mere being. It may even be assumed that just as the unconscious affects us, so the increase in our consciousness affects the unconscious. Jung said that this is the divine service that each of us can be to God, that light may emerge from the darkness, that the Creator may become conscious of his creatures, and man conscious of himself. When we experience the emotional power of dreams or archetypal images, the energy of instinctual desires, or the inspiration of creative ideas, we are experiencing the desire for incarnation welling up from the unconscious. Archetypes, instincts, and creativity are all fueled by psychic energy, and they are all expressions of the self wanting to enter into our lives and make connection with us. So let us look more closely at each of them to see how Jung understood their relationship to desire. First, the archetypes. When we talk about archetypes, it is important to remember that they are both images and emotions. You can't experience an archetypal image without having a strong emotional response. It is a great mistake, Jung said, to treat archetypes as if they were mere concepts or ideas. They are far more than that. They are pieces of life, an image connected with the living individual by the bridge of emotion. An archetype is living matter. When you dream of being held in the arms of your mother, and you have the wonderful feeling that you are finally at home and all is right with the world, and you awaken weeping with joy and longing, you are experiencing an archetype. Or if you are walking down a lonely country lane in the middle of the night with darkness pressing in around you, the wind blowing through the trees, when suddenly you think you see something, pale and ghastly out of the corner of your eye, and an involuntary shudder of terror runs through you, and the hair stands up on the back of your neck, you are experiencing an archetype. When you walk into a crowded room and see the love of your life in the face of a stranger, and your knees go a little weak, and you have this momentary desire to melt into their arms, or when a loud, obnoxious drunk stumbles into you, spilling a whole glass of stale beer on your favorite shirt, and you instantly seethe with rage and want to smash his face in, or when a song, a painting, or a sunset moves you to tears, you are experiencing an archetype. The archetypes, Jung said, are like many little appetites in us. And if they get nothing to eat, they start rumbling and upset everything. The inner man has to be fed. Archetypes are experiences of the primal desire of the unconscious wanting to enter into the lives of each one of us. When it comes to instincts, Jung felt that in the last analysis, most of our difficulties come from losing contact with our instincts, with the age-old forgotten wisdom stored up in us. What some people call instinct or intuition, he said, is nothing other than God. God is that voice inside us which tells us what to do and what not to do. In other words, our conscience. Instincts, like archetypes, are the voice of the self, whom Jung at different times called the 2-million-year-old man inside us. Archetypes and instincts subsist side by side, he said, as reflections of the opposition that underlies all psychic energy. When they are working together, instincts provide raw psychic energy to archetypal images. And archetypal images give form and meaning to the instincts. In this way, they assist each other in realizing what Jung called the spiritual goal toward which the whole nature of man strives. And that spiritual goal is to evolve out of our unconscious conditions and to experience ourselves as a whole. Jung said, in the long run, no conscious will can ever replace the life instinct. This instinct comes to us from within, as a compulsion, or will, or command, and if we give it the name of a personal daimon, we are at least aptly expressing the psychological situation. And if, by employing the concept of the archetype, we attempt to define a little more closely the point at which the daimon grips us, we have only approached closer to the source of life. Now let's look at creativity. In one of his letters, Jung wrote, "To be is to do and to make." Our creative ability comes largely from the unconscious, with the same goal as the archetypes and the instincts, to fulfill the desire of the unconscious to be realized in and through human action. Our will comes not only from our ego, but also from the unconscious. We are also made to be creative and active. For Jung, creativity is a drive, and a creative calling is like having a daimon, an autonomous divine urge, an inner guardian of fate or inspiration. As Jung said, the gods live only in creativeness. There is some kind of artist hiding in all of us. You need to create and make visible in spite of the fact that you can't do it properly, Jung said. You may be a painter who can't paint, or a musician who can't play, but you need to do it anyway. There has always been a creative urge in you, and the desire to express and become who you are is invincibly strong. You need to respond to the pressure of the unconscious and to its desire to produce with the humble means at your disposal. Never mind the imperfections of technique, Jung said. The contents wanting to come to light are the thing that matters. And in case there's some reaction that any of you might be having to that, in another letter, Jung wrote, "Doubt is creative if it is answered by deeds." Here's how Jung described this daimonic creative energy in his own life. "All my writings may be considered tasks imposed from within. Their source was a fateful compulsion. What I wrote were things that assailed me from within myself. I permitted the spirit that moved me to speak out. I have had much trouble getting along with my ideas. There was a daimon in me, and in the end, its presence proved decisive. It overpowered me. And if at times I was ruthless, it was because I was in the grip of the daimon." Well, I hope that this has given you some flavor of how archetypes, instincts, and creativity are all part of the same expression of desire. The desire of the unconscious to seek outward manifestation, as Jung said, so it can realize itself in your life. One of the values of conceptualizing psychic energy in terms of desire is that it helps to personify our relationship to the unconscious. This personification of the unconscious and its products, it's what comes up, is one of Jung's greatest contributions. Because then, as Jung says, hate and love, fear and reverence, enter the scene of the confrontation and raise it to a drama. What has merely been displayed becomes acted. The whole man is challenged and enters the fray with his total reality. Only then can he become whole, and only then can God be born, that is, enter into human reality and associate with man in the form of man. Now, I realize that I have been describing mainly the positive aspects of desire in our relationship with the unconscious. However, all of you know that it is not as easy as that. Even as we may long for union, we also have what Jung described as an invincible dread of becoming more conscious. We feel powerless in our lives and want more control, not less. We do not want to be told that we have to surrender to the self. And yet, the word happens to us, as Jung says. We are its victims. The victims of profound uncertainty and conflict, both in ourselves and in the unconscious. For the unconscious is ambivalent as well as we are. The unconscious wants to flow into consciousness in order to reach the light, but at the same time it continually thwarts itself because it would rather remain unconscious. This is the theme of what I feel is Jung's greatest book, Answer to Job. The self, the God image, is ambivalent. He is a complexio oppositorum, as Jung said. In other words, he is opposed to himself. With the unconscious, all things are possible in the fullest meaning of the phrase, truth and delusion, good and evil. We cannot and should not abandon our reason. But, Jung says, equally, we must cling to the hope that instinct will hasten to our aid, in which case God is supporting us against God. We have to struggle with the unconscious, not just give in to it. The way through this conflict is to be found only by finding the middle path, which is just as much with as against God, Jung said. This path moves with the desires of the unconscious, inasmuch as the unconscious urges us toward consciousness. But it is against the desires of the unconscious, inasmuch as our Luciferian nature insists on autonomy and free will. The conflict we experience is in fact a product of the conflict within the self. And it is through our efforts to reconcile that conflict between our longing for and dread of union with the self that wholeness begins to be born. Jung once said, "The meaning of the tree is neither in the roots nor in the uplifted crown, but in the life in between them. You are the mediator." It is also important to acknowledge that this struggle to balance conscious and unconscious desires imposes an ethical responsibility upon us, both to our unconscious and to our own living relationships. On the one hand, the more we know the desires of the unconscious, the greater becomes our moral obligation to them. These archetypal, instinctual, and creative desires, quote, transform themselves into your individual tasks and duties as soon as they become conscious, unquote. You then have the duty to both understand them and to realize them in your life. Failure to do either deprives you of your wholeness and creates a painful, fragmented existence. If you fail to respond to these desires, you are, as Jung said, virtually amputating the corresponding part of your psyche. On the other hand, there may be very good and ethical reasons for not acting on particular desires in your life. You also have an ethical duty to those you love, and who love and depend on you. In that case, you must consciously confess to yourself your inability and acknowledge that you have neglected to do something of vital importance to your psyche. In this way, you can make amends for your lack of a positive act, Jung says, by the clear acknowledgement of your failure to resolve the conflict. But in any event, the middle path to wholeness requires that you maintain a conscious awareness of your responsibilities to both your unconscious and to your life and relationships. In other words, you must struggle with the grief and anguish of limitation. I'm coming to the end of the lecture, and you may be wondering at this point why this lecture was entitled The Alchemy of Desire. It's because alchemy is about the transformation of nature through human intervention. An opus contra naturam, as the alchemists called it, a work against nature. The desire of the self to incarnate, combined with our desire to be conscious, transforms nature. It transforms our psyche. When we participate in the transformation of unconscious desire into living matter, we in turn are transformed by the unconscious and are helped in our desire to become more fully ourselves. At the end of his life, Jung expressed his personal myth. In it, we human beings are indispensable for the completion of creation. In fact, we are the second creators of the world. As conscious beings, we alone are responsible for giving to the world its objective existence. Without us, creation would have gone on unseen and unheard in the profoundest night of non-being. Jung strongly believed that the creative effort of our consciousness gives us an indispensable place in the great process of being. So if you come away tonight with only one thing, I hope it is that desire, passion, and emotion are the creative forces in your life. Desire comes to us from the unconscious. It is both spiritual and instinctual, transcendent and lusty, joyful and shameful. Desire is truly at the heart of Jung's psychology, because desire, in all its passion and conflict, is at the heart of the relationship between the ego and the self, between you and your unconscious. The self desires to be in relationship with you just as much, if not more, than you desire to be in relationship to it. So your life is one story of the self-realization of the unconscious. Everything in your unconscious desires outward manifestation, just as you too desire to experience yourself as a whole. And desire is what makes this possible. Thank you. Yes.
Before it begins, you said something where I tried to catch it, but I'm not sure I did. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's that besides a responsibility to those we're in relationship with and to our life, we also have a responsibility to the unconscious, to our unconscious, and to what comes up, dreams, things that come up for us, things we realize through paying attention to our dreams or paying attention to experiences that we have that come up for us in our unconscious. And once we become aware of those, we have both a responsibility to try and understand it, try and figure out what it is that that's about. And then, Jung says, we have a responsibility to act on it, to make whatever that is in some way or another real in our lives. And there are times when that we are in conflict because not just because we're struggling with our desire to not have to do the work, but because what comes up for us is something that would cause pain or suffering or for us or for other people. And so we have to struggle with, how do we reconcile? How can we be ethical, not only to our lives, but also to our unconscious desires? And he said, sometimes we have to acknowledge that we cannot respond to those desires. But the only way to do it and not have it be something that's cut off and then becomes a problem is to admit consciously to ourselves that we can't do this, we can't act on this, and that not acting on it is in some way or another failing to do something that our unconscious feels is vitally important. Now I would add to that is also the value and the importance of symbolic enactment, of expressing whatever is coming up, whatever images or feelings or desires that are coming up from the unconscious, if it doesn't feel to you that it's possible to really go do that, it's one thing to suddenly have the inspiration that you want to go paint. You've got, something in you says you've got to go paint. Now you could go paint. You could make the ethical, you could take the ethical, what Jung says is the ethical and moral responsibility to respond to that, to act on that. But it's another thing if the unconscious says, oh, you should go run off to Tahiti and leave everyone you know and go to Tahiti and become a beach bum, That may be something your unconscious wants you to do. But you've decided that that's not something that you can do. So there are ways to respond to it symbolically. There are ways to give voice, to give expression to what comes up for us in a symbolic way and to acknowledge that we're having to enact it symbolically rather than live it out.
Is this what you mean by the threat of confronting yourself?
It's part of it. It's part of it.
I'm interested in how, when I think of the threat of confronting myself, I think of the threat of owning the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
But did you mean that or something more by that?
Well, you see, this is part of shadow work, isn't it? I mean, it's part of shadow work in several different ways, it seems to me. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about instinct is because Jung over and over again talks about how in our 20th century, certainly in our modern culture, and in our culture of having grown up in the Enlightenment, we have basically demonized instinct. We think there's something wrong with instinct. We're always trying to control it. We're always feeling like it's something that we have to control, otherwise it's going to take us over. And when you demonize something, it goes into the shadow, and it takes on a life of its own. And so that's one of the things about, that's one of the ways that this is related to shadow, is that there are things that come up in the unconscious that they come up because they have been put into the shadow. They are parts of ourselves or aspects of our natural sense of who we are that we have, for one reason or another, have rejected. And we have to come to terms with that. And we get confronted by the unconscious when these things come up and we feel and we get what they used to call neurotic. We get depressed or we get anxious or we feel like we don't have any, you know, we don't have any meaning in our life. And we have to look at what is it that's missing? What is it that I am rejecting? What is it that's trying to get my attention that I say, no, I can't do that. I'm too busy. Or that, what would people think of me if they knew that, you know, that I like to hang around, you know, with loggers. I don't know. Wear women's clothes. I was suddenly, Monty Python occurred to me. But I don't know if I'm answering your question.
It's a very difficult question to answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, let's kind of keep a hold of it and maybe we'll kind of come back to it. Yes, I saw a hand over there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Desire, the archetype, is asking for something you're saying no.
Mm-hmm.
And in that grieving, that struggle, and if it's not laid to rest, in other words, if the grief doesn't seem to be symbolic acknowledgement, and maybe it transforms into something else at that point. And I'm wondering at what point you clearly discern that no, I must
it sounds like there are two questions there, and
yeah.
I think the first question probably is an individual question, and it's going to have to do with each individual and the circumstances, and that's part of the struggle is coming to that.
Right.
The second question is, what happens if you do make a symbolic acknowledgement and you do stay conscious and it still doesn't help? I'm not sure. Maybe that means that you have to continue to work on it. Why hasn't it helped? Why isn't it enough? What is it that maybe needs to be done that hasn't been done?
So if this is a guidance consciousness guiding you, if it doesn't work, then it's indicating that there's more work to be done.
Yeah, I think it's important and helpful to think of what we're talking about as a process of relationship.
Right.
We have in a way I think part of what Jung tried to say all his professional life is that we have lost our relationship with our own psyche, with our own unconscious. And we have to work at making that relationship conscious again. Because right now, because for most of us, it's unconscious. And when it's unconscious, all of that stuff, all whatever it is that wants to get, you know, born into life, tries to do it in this autonomous, kind of complex sort of way. Complex, like, you know, the complexes. You know, I didn't talk about complexes because basically, everything I said about archetypes is true of the complexes, because the core of every complex is an archetype. So, there's some hands, but let me, you, and then we'll take you.
Well, you talked about we have lost touch with your psyche. Is there some, where is the condition, what's the closest part?
There's sort of a cycle. Individually, there is the process of there is the process of maturation. You know, the way Jungians tend to think about infancy is that when we're in infancy, we are in an archetypal world. That we basically experience everything that's in our world as archetypal. It's all numinous. It's all. And that the first task we have after we're born is not to get into relationship with the unconscious. Our first task is to get out of the unconscious, is to separate from the unconscious. This is to become a good, solid, working ego, you know, that can say, okay, there you are, and here I am, and what do you got to say for yourself? You know, a good, solid, working ego, I mean, that's our first task, and we spend the first half of our life working on that, at least. Well, yeah. It's a loss only maybe in retrospect. You see, we spend the first half of our life getting that ego going and separating from the unconscious, because the unconscious, this is the other side, you see. The unconscious is like, it will just, you know, there's this fear that will just envelop us. It'll just swallow us up, and we'll never be seen again. And then where's the light of our consciousness? And so we have to spend that time in our first 20 or 30 years getting our ego out of, you know. Remember in Jung, in those first two sentences that I read to you of Jung's autobiography, he said, his word, and the personality too desires to evolve out of its unconscious origins and experience itself as a whole. So the first thing it has to do is evolve out of its unconscious origins. You know, that's the first task. We got to get out. And so by necessity, we end up over here, back over here with the shadow issue. Because one of the things that happens when we're working at getting out of the unconscious is we got to say, okay, this is me. No, that's not me. Okay, this is me. No, that's not me. Okay, all the not me's over here. All the me's over here. And I'm going to go stand. Whoops. I'm going to go stand over here with the me's. And all the not me's are over there. Now, all the not me's are parts of ourselves that came up as we were growing up. But we said, no, I'm not a bad person. I'm not a person that would hit Johnny for taking my truck, you know, and I'm not a person that would not want to give my sister part of my mashed potatoes, or I'm not a person that would be angry at my mother for not giving me what I want. I'm a good boy. So right away we're saying, okay, the bad me is the part that I'm not. And the good me is the part that I am. And that's part of the process of becoming an ego. Is that we're, you know, and we end up, we got an ego here, we got a shadow here, or something. I mean, but we end up not only with an ego, but we end up with a shadow. We end up with parts of ourselves that we don't. And so that's part of what we have to do, that's part of what we have to deal with when we get to the point in midlife where suddenly our developmental task, after we've been striving all this time to get away from the unconscious, our developmental task is to turn around and go, where have you been? You've been following me? You know, where, you know, the shadow and the anima and the unconscious and the self. And our developmental task then at midlife is to reconnect with that unconscious, but now in a conscious way. So long answer. But I remembered.
Towards the end, I want to ask you if you could recall some stuff that you said right toward the end. It's something like desire, passion, something or be. I didn't get it. I want to ask you a question about that. Right at the end.
Let's see. I know I said that. Let's see.
Emotion or be something.
Desire.
Are you creative forces?
Yes. Desire comes to us from the unconscious. No. Let's see.
Desire, passion, and emotion are these creative forces.
Oh, it was what I wanted you to remember. That's right. I hope it is that. But I don't remember. That's why I wanted you to remember. Desire, passion, and emotion are the creative forces in your life.
So my question is, some disciplines, for example, like Buddhism, and others which I have read, for example, like Alcoholics Anonymous, really have some hand in the principles of that. Those disciplines advocate surrender of self, and giving up of self to a great degree, okay? Or that the self is nothing in the case of Buddhism. And so how do I balance, and this is more personal, how do I balance that with my desire and activity as an artist to really express all of the pride, passion, creativity in my life, and at the same time to try to integrate these other, for example, Buddhism into my life, which is give everything up. I mean, it's a constant for me. I'm just wondering how young I am.
Well, it's a big and important question, and I'll try and answer it a little bit, because my sense of you having asked that question, I wish not only I'd brought this, but I've got about 15 pages of quotes that I gleaned out of all sorts of places, and in one of those quotes, which I didn't bring, I found it interesting because he compares his attitude to the attitude of the East, to the yogi, for example, or the Buddhist, that he says something like, well, the yogi meditates in order to let go of self or to get rid of self. And he said, I don't want to get rid of the self. I want to struggle with the self. I want to be in relationship with the self. I want to know what, I want to be in relationship with what it is that comes up. And so I think he would say that.
So he would not be a Buddhist.
Well, he had an ambivalent relationship to Eastern religion and philosophy. On the one hand, he used some of the terminology. His term, the self, came from the Atman, you know, in Hindu religion, and I think he admired a lot of it because he recognized that Eastern religions are very an unconscious religion. They're much more aware of their relationship to the unconscious than Western religions are. But he did say very clearly that Western man should not try and be Eastern. You know, Western man has to deal with the unconscious images and unconscious religious and spiritual images that come up in his tradition for him. I'm a little more laissez-faire when it comes to. I would say that it's what's important is to pay attention to what it is that comes up, and to work on that, and not say, "Well, if it if you start, if what comes up are images of the Buddha, then, you know, we can, you know, it's, you should be having images of somebody else, you know, some Western figures. And I'm not sure if Jung would really say that, but I think that you need to, as far as Jung is concerned, you need to be clear about the fact that what's necessary is a relationship to the unconscious and to the unconscious material. And recognizing, everything, when he talked about God and when he finally got around to writing Answer to Job, it's clear that he's very much thinking that the imagery is very much within the Judeo-Christian tradition. That was his personal struggle, I think, on that issue and on that level. And that's the way that's the myth that he saw really made sense to him about how to explain what's going on for the individual. Now, I have a feeling that I didn't really get to all that you were talking about. But now, are you still? Okay. I'm afraid I couldn't answer that. I don't have enough experience with cancer patients to really give a knowledgeable answer about that. Sorry.
Can you? Finally, response of earlier Buddhism.
Yeah.
I think it's a matter of misunderstanding the terminology and words, because I've had this discussion with other Buddhists.
Okay.
I am a Buddhist. And in Buddhism, somehow they equate the self and the ego as the same thing. In my mind, it's not. So if you separate it, when they use the word self, they're talking about ego. They're not talking about the self that you're thinking about. So as long as you have that, you separate those two, there's no problem.
You can also use the capital.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to that.
Sure.
From Buddhist perspective, because we have this discussion at the temple, and it's not that desire or passion or emotion are things that you want to give up, it's the attachment to them. Now, you do continue to experience desire, emotion, creativity, these things, but what you're giving up is your attachment to them. There's a distinction there, and supposedly people who give up their attachment can still, you know, be joyful, be sad, be engaged, be empathetic, etc., but they're not no longer having an ego attachment to those things.
I tend to think of myself as a Zen Taoist. And that's my current religious affiliation. In line with what you're saying, I often think of I try and understand for myself, or maybe it's that this is what I sort of strive for is passionate detachment. Okay? To feel like you have that sense of being that you're not caught by it, but you're passionately engaged with it. Maybe that has to do with consciousness or something. That's why it's an ideal. Who was? I think you were next.
Well, I think there's one thing about that question that you comment about that ego and something. In AA, it's the same thing. There's no ego. It's just like that. And I want to go back to that question about finding the balance between listening to that voice and being responsible to others. How does Jesus fit into
My guess would be that Jung would say that Jesus would be an example of someone who did make a an ethical decision as opposed to a moral decision. Jung tended to make a distinction. Morality, he tended to say morality was about convention and whether you're following the laws and whether you're doing what the church says you should do. And ethics is about listening to the voice of God within you, you know, kind of thing. Listening to your conscience and deciding what is your ethical responsibility, because he was, of course, he was talking as an introvert. So it's always you go inside and you check inside and say, where is that? Where is the knowing? And then you come out and say, okay, now I've figured out how I'm going to respond, how I need to act. And I think that Jung would say that Jesus was an example of that, where he didn't go into his father's trade. He didn't become a carpenter. He followed some other path. Even though we don't know, do we know how his mother really felt about that? I mean, isn't there some place where he came to preach and he came into town to preach and something about his mother and his sister? Yeah, and his mother, and as I'm a little fuzzy now. It's been a long time, but this notion that I think it's where we get the phrase you're never a prophet in your own in your own hometown, you know, or your own country. That so I think from one perspective you could see Jesus as being someone who made that ethical choice because he was following an inner calling. I had some other hands. Yes?
I lived in the next school for a long time, which I recall Archetype Land.
Mm-hmm.
And now I live in Seattle, which I recall Microsoft Land. And I wonder if...
There was life before Microsoft.
Yeah, it's not... I mean, I wonder if there is any more. And I wonder... Yes, well, the archetype that I'm wondering about is speed.
Speed.
And the effect of speed... Working at all with your conscious seems to me impossible if you try to perform at the level at which the current archetype of speed expects you to. How do you get in front of that?
Are you thinking of speed as some archetypal imperative that's being...
Well, it's starting to feel like that.
Is it? I'm trying to defend against the notion that it's some archetypal imperative, but I probably tend to see it as some cultural imperative that we're caught up in.
Can be,
but I don't know. Does anybody else have any thoughts about that? Because I got your hand first. Yeah. Or you could end up identifying with it and getting caught by it, and suddenly you're inflated. Sure. Well, it's interesting. One of the quotes I ran across or sort of leaped out at me was, I think it must be in Memory, Dreams, Reflections. Jung's talking about a dream he had. And it's a rather elaborate dream, but he's in this big sort of sacred sort of space, like an Eastern sort of, and and he's down on the tile floor, and he's supposed to bow to the floor, to this symbol of the self that's in the room. And he says that he finds himself, he bows to the floor, and he gets his forehead almost to the floor, but not quite. You know? Just about a half an inch from the floor. He just can't bring himself in the dream to actually touch his. And he says, this is an acknowledgement of the fact that as conscious egos, there is that, it's what I refer to as that Luciferian, our Luciferian nature. There's that part of us that says, yes, I, you know, of course, I need to surrender to the self. I need to bring in the aspects of the unconscious that well up in me. I need to be in relationship. And there's just that one little piece that says, no, I'm not gonna. I'm me. I'm me, and I'm gonna stay me, and I don't care what the self thinks of it. You know, that's it. I'm gonna get close there, but I'm not gonna just do everything. I'm not gonna go all the way. I'm just gonna disappear. Do you remember another dream that was a very important dream for Jung that he talked about? Where this was as a young man. I think that this is it's very significant that he had this dream as a young man who was just going to college and trying to get himself out of the unconscious. You know, as we were talking about. Remember, it's the dream where he dreams he's in the dark and he's carrying this little flame, this little candle, and he's trying to keep the candle lit, you know, and he realizes behind him is this huge black something. You know, and he realizes his task is to keep the candle from being snuffed out by this huge black something behind him.
He's walking through a tempest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The wind from blowing the candle up.
And there's this thing behind him. There's this big shadowy thing behind him that he's afraid will overwhelm him and the candle too. Right. So it's both. He's coming from both, I think. And his interpretation of the dream is that he said he realized that the dark shadow behind him, this huge shadow behind him, was his, what he called at that time his number two personality. It was the self. And that was what, and he says that he was so amazed to realize that's not something he would ever have thought of himself, that this shadowy, frightening figure behind him was actually this superior part of himself that he had to protect the light of his ego from at that point in his life. It was partly out of that dream that he decided he had to stop thinking and worrying about the number two personality and get on with his life and to get out into life and be an ego and to make decisions and to get involved in his studies and his life and do things, you know. So there seems to be, I was, where were we? There's
also, and in fact, the shadow of this massive force only became conscious, that is to say, recognizable, because of this allegedly inadequate quality of the consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, the little candle was actually probably what was creating in the way. But he had to, it was a dream where Jung was dreaming, he had to protect the ego from being overwhelmed by the unconscious and chaos. You know. We got some 10 up. You want to take a break and then we can come back? Okay. About how we need to get in touch with desire, but what happens if we can't, or what happens if we lose our connection and feel like we've lost it? And so I would like to spend the time having a conversation about that and talking about that, and to hopefully spark that conversation. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the story, the myth of Aristaeus and his bees. It's a story from Virgil. Virgil wrote a long poem about country life called the Georgics. And in one of those poems, he talks about Aristaeus, who in Greek mythology was considered the first person to cultivate bees. He learned how to cultivate bees from the gods. He was sort of this half divine hero who got taught how to get honey and how to cultivate bees. So Aristaeus was the first beekeeper in Greek mythology. And it's the story of how he loses his bees and the journey he goes on to find out how to get them back. And for those of you who might into the classics, right in the middle of the story of Aristaeus and his bees, Virgil puts the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. And in fact, I just recently learned that version is the earliest version we have of the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. So, for you classic scholars, anyway, some more. We'll have a little more discussion about. I was thinking about speed. You were talking about speed during the break, and I was your question reminded me of an experience I had. Must be now 15 years ago or so, 15, 16 years ago. I went to the wilds of Canada on a week-long Vision Quest workshop. It was in what they call the Near North, 250 miles north of Toronto. It sounds like it's really far out there, but if you look on the map, it's due east. my sensation function is so it's out there somewhere. Yeah, it's pretty much due east, and it was on an island with no electricity, no running water, and it was 40-minute float plane ride from the nearest settlement, right? So it was kind of out there. And after a week on the island, I developed, in terms of this business about speed, I was aware that I had fallen into what I later called tamagami time, because I found myself just sort of walking around and, sort of not being in a hurry and just kind of, And this was my natural, the natural biological, rhythm. Just you're not in a hurry. You're walking and you're on the earth and when my wife picked me up from the airport, I got to SeaTac and my wife's, we greeted each other and there's, of course everybody's getting off the plane and my wife goes in normal time, she goes walking off to the baggage claim area, and I'm still in tamagami time, and I'm sort of walking along, and it was, she got about half a block away before she turned around and said, "What's wrong? Where are you? Come on, let's go." And I realized, I just don't. The reason I'm telling that story is, if we really get in touch with what's our speed, not what society is telling us we should be going at, but if we really got in touch with what our speed was, we'd probably find out it isn't 60 cycles a second. I don't really think that's my bias. I don't want to think that that's an archetypal imperative. That what's really the archetypal imperative is to survive in a world where it is running at 60 cycles a second. And we are running at one heartbeat a second. So. Yes?
I was making some intuitive connections that may not make sense to anybody. But thinking, using Microsoft as a technological advancement, and somewhere running water. Now, I was saying, running water? Why isn't it walking water or something else? that's a name for a technological advancement. And there's speed involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
The label, the water coming out of the tap is running.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's a meaning somewhere. You know, I don't know what it is.
It's hard to imagine a time when water was one of the fastest things around. When water was running, because it was going faster than we could, you know?
So would you prefer the term flowing water?
Well, that sounds nicer. Yeah. More relaxing.
if you look at the newspapers, you know, from 1800s, late 1800s, it's really interesting that they show headlines full of giant eagles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Look what happened to him. Yeah. Wait a minute. You don't. It's not about withdrawal.
It
should. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the other side of it is to remember. We start personifying it and separating it. Like it's happening. It's doing. It's doing it to us. We created it. That's our creation. And so it's part. I think it's part of. It's probably, you know, if we wanted to think generally, it's part. Probably part of. Humankind's struggle to find to be in balance with what it is we create.
Yeah, the scary part of this is like World War One. I mean, they actually thought that they put something in that machine that was going to break. When they came onto that thing, they had to break.
Right.
And it was devastating.
Right.
They didn't know what to do for years. They wrote that. I still don't know.
Mm-hmm. You had your hand.
In that you have to accept the limitation of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And the moral obligation on the one half of the security of life is to go to society.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there are times when it's great to be on the crest of the wave, you know, and you're just going in there, and oh boy, I'm getting lots of stuff done. And, you know. There was a hand up over here.
I just
want
to bring back the question of the relationship of creativity and speech. And like I think that there is a lot of creativity, at least I don't know which of my problems. I do know some people have some personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's a lot of creativity.
Sure, there is. Of course. Of course.
Well, yes, the speed of your exciting spirit, right? And, you know, to be the first one is the defining force of speed. You can be the first one, but the second one.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
So the speed thing is more connected to the competition than the difference. It does increase the risk.
I don't think it does. It might, but I don't think it has to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
But I mean, what is sort of the union response when desire and creativity and passion are not present in the life? Is it back again to the Eastern versus Western view to be not attached to either the passion or to the absence of passion? Is that a union response, or is there something to become, go work at Microsoft and try to get it back?
I would say one Jungian response from a Jungian, from this Jungian, is that the answer is to be curious, to be curious about where has it gone and why has it gone there? What's going on? What has happened? Why am I depressed? Why am I anxious? Why am I feeling so bereft? Why am I feeling so empty? What is happening? And to be willing to be open to not only engaging what's there, but being open to waiting, you know. But I think it's really about engaging and being curious and moving toward what it is that has left. In a way,
it's not as simple as just saying, "Oh well, I'm going to be attached to it, let it go." That's not.
Well, if you get there after, I mean, if that's where you get to, having gone through the grief and dealing with what's there, that's fine. You had your hand up. You still.
The electromagnetic energy moves at that. Prana moves much faster than that. The problem moves much faster than that. So that in fact, it's sort of mercury compared with Saturn or lead. It's not. In fact, Microsoft is moving slower than we are. That we're moving much faster. So why is it that we feel rushed?
Mm-hmm.
What is it in my red nature that sort of gives my feels?
To me, the issue of speed, when I've sat with it, it feels to me the problematic nature of it, as at least I heard it being talked about, it's about fear. Fear is like the problematic issue. I mean, if I'm revved up and I'm moving and I feel like I'm really, you know, that's fine. But if I become afraid, or if there's some dissonance between the energy, you know, my pace and the pace that is being imposed on me, then I think fear crops up. And that's where I think it's the fear that we have to deal with, whatever it is that we're an issue with. And it occurs to me that something I didn't mention, but in my working on desire, I came to the realization that the opposite of desire is not hate or anger. The opposite of desire is fear.
David, you talked about that rhythm. I can't remember what rhythm it was.
Tamagami, yeah.
There's that factor too, where it's just the, you know, you're at going in a different rhythm than the rest of the world or
somebody else.
No,
it's just no. I mean, if you feel comfortable with the rhythm you're in, if you feel you're being forced to change rhythms, I think that's when it becomes something fearful. Okay.
Well, I hear people talking about creativity and passion and desire and making all one together, but the lack of desire and emotion, or what we call depression, is also essential. We're talking about a process.
Mm-hmm.
And you himself would have terrible depression.
Right.
And maybe 30 days. At the end of it, he would break out and still the creativity would go on for months.
Mm-hmm.
Rilke talks about the same process in letters to the important.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a cycle. We're talking about a cycle.
Absolutely. And it may very well be that those times where as Jung would say, the gradient shifts and all the psychic energy goes inward and there's nothing coming out. Those are times of incubation. I mean, at one point he talked about that he recognized that he had dreams in which his anima left and went, I can't remember whether it's went into heaven or went into the earth or something, but the anima The anima left. And he recognized, he realized that what happened was that eventually she came back. And when she did, she brought new creative energy with her. It was like she went into the unconscious and then came back with this new energy. And I think that's what you may be talking about. I'm afraid if I sit on that table, it'll break. But I desire to sit on it anyway. See, fear and desire. So I can't actually do what I desire because I'm. You know. It came, that realization came to me sort of phenomenologically, if you will. I mean, it seems to me that when we are afraid, it does not leave. I mean, desire has been pushed off the stage. I mean, there's no room for desire. When we are connected, when we're in the flow. When we're really, really connected to a creative desire, creative process, there's no room for fear. Another way to think about it is the way in which Winnicott talked about play space. You know, that in play space, in Jungian terms, that liminal temenos, or that temenos, inside that space, there is no fear, because you have to be open to whatever is there and totally engaged in it. You remind me of an analogy that I like to use. Imagine you're in the woods. You're in the forest, not just in the woods. The woods are manageable. You're in the jungle, and it's nighttime. And you're in a clearing in the jungle, so that you know that you can see around you. But in the middle of the clearing, you've built a fire. And it's in the middle of the night. It is the jungle. There's no lights. There's no nothing. There's no moon. But you hear those animals out there on the other side of the light from that fire. You hear those animals and you hear their growls. And you know, it's frightening. You don't know who they are or whether they're going to decide to jump in and have you for a late midnight snack or what, you know. But you're sitting there at the fire and you're trying to read a book by the light of that fire. How far into that book do you think you're going to get? Not very far. You find yourself reading, you know, those moments when you find yourself reading the same paragraph over and over and over again. I know I read this, but I don't remember anything of it. That to me is a description of what happens when we're anxious, when we're afraid. You know, anxiety. I mean, we like to talk about anxiety. Anxiety is a fancy adult word for being afraid, right? And that being in that situation, that's the situation we're in a lot, where we're trying to concentrate, we're trying to be creative, we're trying to be connected, we're trying to do something where we have focus and we have attention. And our fear keeps us from being able to focus. So, just as an analogy, that's one of the ways I think about that. But it seems to me that anger and rage those are ways to be engaged with somebody. If you've got an enemy, you know, there's a real relationship there. You know, you really care about what happened to him or her. Or, you know, you hope that they fall off a cliff, and by God, you know, you might give them a push, but. I mean, you got a relationship. There's desire there. There's engagement. There's connection. So it's, yeah.
I'm afraid to have time to
Oh, okay.
We'll have to meet you tomorrow.
Yes, tomorrow.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you all very much.